Case on our 1130 docket is State v. Cruz-Hernandez. It's case number 58622. Mr. Mills for the appellant and Mr. Lee for the respondent. I would note for the record that no reply brief was filed, so there will be no opportunity for rebuttal in this case. Mr. Mills, are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Very well.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Mills. I am the attorney for the appellant in this case, the State of Nevada. And the issue that we are here to discuss this morning is the issue of whether a juvenile was in custody for a violation of the law and who thereafter commits a battery can properly be considered a prisoner under the applicable law and accordingly charged with battery by a prisoner in lawful custody or confinement, which is a felony by virtue of its having been committed by somebody who is in custody, somebody who's characterized or defined as a prisoner. In deciding this issue, in discussing this issue, of course, which is how to define the term prisoner, this is not a case where that term is not defined for us. There are many cases, as you all know, where attorneys and judges sit around discussing and arguing about how to define a particular term which is not expressly defined by statute. There are many cases where that is the case. That is not the case here. What we have here is a term that we're trying to determine whether that term applies to a particular situation. We're discussing a term that is expressly defined by statute, and that statute is NRS 193.022. And therefore, our discussion of how to interpret what constitutes a prisoner should begin with the actual definition of a prisoner as enunciated by the Nevada legislature. NRS 193.022 defines a prisoner this way. Prisoner includes any person held in custody under process of law or under lawful arrest. And it is unquestioned, it is undisputed, that in this case, the respondent was being held in custody under process of law. I don't think anyone would argue that a juvenile who commits a delinquent act and is adjudicated delinquent and ends up in a juvenile correctional facility of some sort is not being held under process of law.
So Robinson was incorrectly decided.
Robinson was correctly decided, I believe.
Was correctly decided?
Was correctly decided.
Well, he was incarcerated, or held, I should say, at least, under a process of law?
Yes, he was. A slightly different process of law. In this case, we're dealing with somebody who's committed to a correctional facility by a judge, a juvenile courtmaster, a juvenile judge, a court. In Robinson, the individual was taken into custody by a police officer, I believe, pursuant to the civil commitment statute. So I guess, yes, that would be a process of law. And
so why aren't you arguing that Robinson is incorrectly decided?
Because I think there's an important distinction between Robinson and the case at bar.
What is it?
And that distinction allows us to maintain Robinson, which I really don't have an issue with the way Robinson was decided. I don't think it was wrongly decided.
Well, maybe that you don't have an issue, but for precedential purposes, this court is going to have to, if it accepts your position, explain why there's a difference between the outcome in Robinson and the outcome you've advocated, and I'm trying to understand that difference.
Yeah,
so what is it?
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. Here's the difference. In my view, this is the state's position, as that because, again, you know, under all applicable definitions of a prisoner under the statute, under Dumaine, which talks about involuntary restraint, confinement, or custody, it's indisputable. This juvenile delinquent would qualify as a prisoner. So the issue then becomes State v. Robinson and whether State v. Robinson is applicable to the case at bar. And as you all recall, State v. Robinson dealt with the civil commitment statute where somebody was publicly intoxicated and was taken into custody and thereafter committed a battery, was charged with battery by a prisoner. The court in State v. Robinson held that not a prisoner. And the language of the holding of the court in State v. Robinson is extremely important. The court held, we hold that the term prisoner only applies to individuals in custody for criminal conduct and not to persons in civil protective custody. It's the state's position that the holding should be read narrowly. The court was saying it does not apply to situations involving persons in civil protective custody. It only applies to individuals in custody for criminal conduct. And here's the distinction between the case at bar and Robinson. In Robinson, there was no violation of a criminal code committed by the individual taken into custody. There simply was not. By legislative mandate, public intoxication had been specifically and expressly decriminalized. However, the legislature allowed for purposes of protecting individuals who were publicly intoxicated or protecting the public, they provided for the civil commitment mechanism, but they expressly said, we are not criminalizing this conduct. That's the major difference between Robinson and the case at bar, is that the individual in State v. Robinson had not committed a violation of the law and was not in custody for having committed a violation of the law. In the case at bar, a juvenile delinquent who is arrested or who goes through the juvenile justice system and is subsequently adjudicated delinquent and committed to a juvenile detention center or some other youth correctional facility has committed a violation of the law. And that goes back to brings me back to the language in Robinson, which states that we hold that the term prisoner only applies to individuals in custody for criminal conduct and not for persons in civil protective custody.
But what is Robinson called? Recites the legislative intent surrounding the holding of inebriants. There couldn't be a greater legislative intent expressed in the context of juveniles that they are civil proceedings. So the Robinson case seemed to turn on what was the underlying purpose for the incarceration or the holding rather than the event that occurred while the individual who is in custody commits a battery. So if we are to follow the teaching in Robinson, it would seem that we're supposed to examine the legislative intent behind the statute that gets the person in the hooscow.
I see your point, Justice Hardesty, and you're correct. There is an express legislative intent with respect to juvenile proceedings. Juveniles who commit violations of the law, we as a society, as a state legislature, have decided to treat them differently because of their youth and age and that sort of thing. And there definitely is a legislative intent in treating those proceedings as civil in nature in order to not stigmatize these juveniles with the language of criminal proceedings. We don't call them defendants and we don't convict them of crimes. We don't use the same terminology. Because of their youth and their age, we've decided to not stigmatize them in that way. But that does not mean that the acts that they engage in, that these delinquent acts, are not violations of the law, and they are.
Is the point you're getting to that the detention in this case, as distinguished from Robinson, looked ahead to further legal action against the detainee because of the violation of law that occurred, regardless of whether it's civil or criminal? That would be different than what Robinson's saying, but it is a distinction between someone in protective civil custody for public drunkenness. Nothing further is going to happen to that person until they sober up and leave. There's no legal cloud hanging over their head that's going to be visited upon them before they get out of that setting. Whereas it seems to me that the juvenile in this case was held under process of law, which is to say threat of further proceeding for an antecedent violation of law. Is that the argument you're trying to make?
That's correct.
If so, why wouldn't that require us to revisit Robinson, and can we as a three-judge panel do that?
Well, I think certainly a stare decisis is an important concept, and when possible, you ought to rely on precedent. But if there are compelling reasons to revisit a case and reconsider the rationale for it, or reconsider the unintended consequences of it, for example. For example, a court deciding Robinson may not have anticipated or even thought about the implications of that holding in terms of that, Robinson potentially applying to contexts like this. And So certainly the court can revisit a prior holding. Frankly, I don't see a need for it necessarily. I think there are distinctions, there is an important distinction between this type of case and Robinson.
So would it be okay, counsel? One of the hypotheticals that is part of our preparation was this. The individual, as in Robinson, who was placed in custody with no technical legal consideration hanging over him, just sobering up. If he or she beat the heck out of one of his guards, is he fully and wholly exempted from the statute?
Under Robinson, he would be.
Is that a good result?
Well, by beat the heck out of him, the ordinary law of battery would apply. And if it rose to the level of substantial bodily harm, then potentially he could be charged with a felony. If not, he'd be charged with a misdemeanor. But what you described sounds a lot like Robinson, where a guy is in custody for public intoxication, public drunkenness, and commits a battery. And because of the non-civil nature of that, of the reason for him being in custody, or I'm not even sure I'd state it that broadly. The court just stated that this prisoner, the definition of a prisoner does not apply to a person in civil protective custody.
So he's not subject to 200-481 in the example that I gave you.
Which part of 200-481?
So 2F.
2F. Under Robinson, he would not be. That's correct. Yeah. And because this is an issue of first impression for the court, I would point your attention to some of the other courts who have addressed this issue, specifically Wisconsin, in that CDM case that is directly on point. Where the court in that case addressed a very similar issue, a juvenile in a correctional facility called Lincoln Hills, who committed a battery. And the statute, if you look at that case, the statute dealing with battery by a prisoner is very comparable to the Nevada statute. It's a very analogous situation. And the court concluded, we conclude that a delinquent confined to Lincoln Hills is a prisoner within the meaning of the statute. Lincoln Hills is a secured correctional facility. A child confined there obviously has his liberty curtailed. He also must be adjudicated delinquent, which requires a violation of state or federal law. To be confined to Lincoln Hills, a child must be a criminal or must commit a criminal violation. A child is not confined to Lincoln Hills pursuant to a criminal conviction, but he is sent there because he violated the law and for a correctional objective. CDM, therefore, was a prisoner within the meaning of the statute. And out of California, as stated by the plaintiffs in the instant case, proceedings in juvenile court are of a civil rather than a criminal nature. However, the juvenile court has the power to commit a ward to a placement where he is involuntarily restrained and deprived of his liberty by judicial process. And justices, that Wisconsin case in particular, because the statutes are so similar, the facts are so similar, it's directly on point. And that case, if you go and look at it in a little more detail, it goes into the public policy reasons as well, but it just doesn't make a lot of sense that we would let these individuals off the hook necessarily, that there's in talking about public policy and rationales and things of that nature, that there's a very good public policy reason for elevating what otherwise would be a misdemeanor battery to the level of a felony by somebody who's in custody. And that reason is for a deterrent effect, because if they're already in custody, then they don't and they're going to be in custody because, going back to what Justice Pickering was saying, if a juvenile is in custody for a violation of the law, there's a chance that, at the sentencing phase, I don't think it's called sentencing, but at the outcome phase of the adjudicatory process in a juvenile case, that the court, in essence, hands down a sentence. And if a juvenile is going to be in custody anyway for whatever the underlying delinquent act was, then there is no deterrent effect if that person punches someone, commits a battery. So, that's the rationale for elevating what otherwise would be a misdemeanor battery to a felony battery, and that rationale...
Well, the legislature's decision to criminalize battery by a prisoner was not adopted as a deterrent effect against a defendant. It was adopted to protect those who provide security those correctional officers, wherever they serve, whether they be deputy sheriffs in a county jail or correctional personnel in a prison or those who supervise Elko.
That's exactly right, Justice.
And the Robinson case does not examine the purpose of the criminal statute. It examines the purpose of the process of law that puts a person in custody.
That's an excellent point, and that public policy reason as well would apply to both situations, Robinson as well as this case. And if on that basis the court found it prudent to just revisit Robinson altogether for that reason, that's fine. And just one last point before I'm out of time is
I guess it begs the question, could a lawyer who is ordered into contempt and held for 24 hours and smacks the sheriff in the mouth be convicted under this statute?
I believe so. Well, actually, contempt, I believe, is a violation of the criminal code. It's an actual criminal offense, I believe, contempt of court. But that's an interesting hypothetical. My position is that the answer to that hypothetical would depend on whether there was, in fact, a violation of a criminal code, and that was the reason versus a civil reason. But I would direct the court's attention finally. I think this is an extremely compelling point as well to the juvenile justice code itself, which refers to children in particular contexts as prisoners.
Hey, counsel, I'm going to caution you. You are well beyond your time, so please conclude your thoughts.
Okay. Thank you. I would just direct your attention to that and have you consider that a juvenile who escapes is considered a prisoner under the statute. I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. Mr. Lee.
Good morning. My name is Frederick Lee. I'm the public defender in Elko. And I represented Mr. Cruz in this case at the trial level. First of all, my understanding of Robinson, that Robinson was amenable to prosecution for misdemeanor batteries when he hit his cellmates. And the whole gist of that case was that the state argued it was a felony, and his defense lawyers arguing that it was misdemeanors. So he would have a criminal liability if he upped and hit somebody while he was there.
But he wasn't being detained for eventual prosecution or to have the law apply to him.
No. He was there for public drunkenness, and which Mr. Mills pointed out was decriminalized, although it's still a crime in many jurisdictions and was in Nevada up until then. And it's constitutional to have public drunkenness as a crime.
But it was not at the time he was held.
It was after they repealed that law.
Yes.
Your Honors, my reviewing for this case, one thing I'd like to point out is that Mr. Mills says there's no dispute about whether Mr. Cruz was a prisoner or not. And clearly there is a dispute. That's what this case is all about. And in Judge Puccinelli's order dismissing the charges against Mr. Cruz, he clearly said he wasn't a prisoner based on juvenile law. The definition of prisoner they use is either 193.022, which they're proceeding on now, which is under the criminal statutes, and 208.085, I think, is originally charged, which is under the prison statutes. So, and clearly, as Judge Puccinelli put it, there is no analogous criminal, no analogous prisoner. Either you are or you aren't. And in his argument and his finding was that under juvenile law, you weren't. Now, as Robinson and its applicability, Mr. Mills goes from Robinson into Wisconsin cases and the definition in other sections. I think the important in deciding this case is to go through Robinson and compare it to the case at hand. And that's easy for us to do because on page 9 of the in the opinion, under conclusion, there's a when the court is wrapping up its decision, there's a heavy bold set conclusion, and they go through the elements. And the first of those, if you look at that, and it says jail, and they're talking about this case, and they say jail, excuse me, the Nevada legislature has made it clear that public intoxication shall no longer be recognized as a criminal offense. Now then you go over to the 62 sections, the juvenile law, and it starts out, Nevada NRS 62D010 rules out any finding of delinquency to be a criminal offense. NRS 62B330C gives a juvenile court exclusive jurisdiction over juvenile offenses. And Ruth says they aren't criminal with certain exceptions. If you murder somebody, then that's not a, that juvenile court doesn't have jurisdiction. But for most cases and most crimes, except enumerated ones, it does. So the first paragraph there, they seemed, if you make a column, they seem kind of the same. Then the second paragraph says, the legislature finds and declares the handling of alcohol abusers within the criminal justice system is ineffective, whereas treating alcohol abusers as a health problem is prevention. Now you can go over to the juvenile sections, creating it in the case law. It says, the juvenile system is based on the belief that a child's age is important, his minority, his adolescence, or less, and that a child is developing as an adolescent and his character is being built, that he's in a period of transition. And I think that's being upheld by the U.S. court just recently in Millis versus Arkansas, the sentence with life without a being mandatory life without for murder.
Mr. Lee, why isn't the holding of a juvenile in a juvenile detention facility retaining a person in custody under process of law? The criminal statute at issue in this case and in Robinson was, in defining a prisoner, was not focused on what got him into the custody, other than to say that it was pursuant to a process of law. That language is not analyzed in Robinson. So if we were going to address this issue, we'd have to say that that portion of the definition really doesn't apply. How do we say that?
I don't agree. I think that Mr. Mills would have you be a process of law, being he's either guilty of a criminal act or analogous or text or context or criminal-like or criminal-as. That's what he would, I think, tell you. I think that basically we're talking about due process of law. The due process of law allows you to take the drunk in as well as the juvenile. The drunk, the law allows them to hold them up for 48 hours, to use all the force they use for arrest of a criminal, and that they're not liable, that they're doing their job as a peace officer. So I think that you have to have a reason for putting them in custody. And what I think this reason is juvenile and therapeutic and rehabilitative. And so I think that's what you look at, why they're there. It is important.
Well, wasn't the purpose behind criminalizing attacks on detention personnel the purpose of this statute to protect them or to dissuade those who are in custody from attacking them?
Sure. I agree with you that when you
asked
that question.
So why would we examine the underlying reason why they were placed in custody in deciding whether this statute criminalizes or doesn't criminalize their behavior?
Well, I think you...
It seems like the legislature's use of the words under process of law...
It makes it confusing.
It's pretty broad.
I think that the comparison, one of the cases compared to other foreign jurisdictions, and they list the people. It says, if you attack a juvenile peace officer, a truant officer, a school bus driver, then you have this enhancement in the type of statute you're talking about. And Nevada could have done that, and they didn't do that, and that wouldn't have been a problem because you just look at the list. Who's included in the list? And you have juvenile, which is an important issue, I want to get it, juvenile, employees of juvenile NYTC, because it's some question what they are. And that's a question, I think, if you make NYTC a prison, you're ruining its philosophy of rehabilitation. And so that's one of the reasons that the criminal and penal codes don't apply in the definitions to it. And I think it's important. I'd like to do further comparison of the...
So you're suggesting that if the legislature wanted to criminalize, or I should say state in another way, if the legislature wanted to protect personnel in juvenile detention facilities from harm to them caused by juveniles who've been placed there,
it could do so.
That it should have done so in Chapter 62 or some other chapter, but it
right.
has to do so specifically.
Like one of the exemptions for juvenile law is a school activity, authorized school activity. If you attack a teacher, then that can be tried as an adult, and that's an offense. So that is has been done and could have been done. I think that to bootleg penal and criminal definitions into juvenile code is counter to what it is. And we are, Robinson says, well, the reason is important. And then the third paragraph for Robinson says, treatment relieves law enactment of a large and inappropriate burden, drunks. And so I think that you could say the same about juvenile, is that jail is not the place for juveniles. And criminal codes are not the place for juveniles as they're developing in their development.
So your argument would be that a person who's mentally unstable and is placed in the Nevada State Mental Health Hospital because of their instability or their mental defect and who subsequently attacks or commits a battery on one of those persons would not be convicted under this statute.
Wouldn't be a prisoner. I think that's true. Although Wisconsin, the jurisdiction he cites, did find in the subsequent case that a person acquitted of not guilty by reason of insanity that was held in a mental hospital pursuant to their statute was a prisoner. And so that's, I don't think Nevada would do that. I think still the law says...
You're suggesting that the Wisconsin
is a little
holdings...
Tough. And I think this case is a little tough. It was in the 80s with gangs. And juvenile law varies. It isn't a constant. So I think that it varies. And now it's going through a swing where developing psychiatric testimony, MMIs about brains, are all coming and making it, once again, a remedial process.
The difference to my mind on Robinson and this case and arguably the mental health case you just alluded to when you said he was eventually acquitted of not guilty by reason of insanity, that mental health patient must have been subject to some further process of law. He was being held by the state so that the state could do something to him legally down the road.
But he's not a prisoner. He's under the civil commitment of danger to himself or others. That's the only way they can hold him.
But you mentioned that he was acquitted for not guilty by reason of insanity. So there must have been a larger reason.
This is in Wisconsin, not here. Okay.
I understand that. But my point here is this juvenile, compared to the defendant in Robinson, he was held by process of law for further proceedings visiting the law upon him. the person in Robinson was held purely protectively. There was no object of the state to visit further legal proceedings on him until he got sober, he got out. There was no...
I disagree with that. He was sent from parole to NYTC to get counseling and schooling, and the principal, it's in the appendix, the principal at the hearing testified to that they were working on him. He wasn't locked up. He was no jail, no bars. They have no guards there to start with. So that it was a therapeutic reason.
Have an end prosecution or adjudication of delinquency. He wasn't detained.
He had been found delinquent. He had been on parole, probation. He went to NYTC because of violations, and then he was returned to NYTC, where ironically he was graduated and now is still on parole in Clark County.
Why is that not being held under process of law? That's my question. Other than the label criminal versus civil.
Well, the whole thing is why he's held. He is held pursuant to 62, the Juvenile Detention Act, and who it says exclusive jurisdiction of that, not because it's a crime. And they don't mention prisoners in that. And Judge Puccinelli's order is saying he is not a prisoner. If you read Judge Puccinelli's order, it's being appealed.
But isn't he still under process of law? I think really that's where we're trying to get. I mean, regardless of how you label him, juvenile or otherwise, doesn't the term under process of law encompass something broader than prisoner?
I think if you wasn't under process of law, you'd have false imprisonment holding him. He has to be there for some legal reason. They have to have a legal reason to take the drunk off the road, and they have that under 484, whatever that section is, and to use force against them.
Do you make anything of the fact, I mean, this is ultimately a statutory interpretation question. I thought it was interesting that 62B-401 expressly says a juvenile is a prisoner for purposes of escape statutes. And they don't with respect to battery by a prisoner.
That's very important, and that's in Judge Puccinelli's order. He says that argument is, I feel the state, if they wanted to make this, that they could have done it, they didn't do it. And then he says, I don't think it was an accident. I don't think they wanted to.
Have a specific expression saying, in this instance, a juvenile is a prisoner, but in no other by implication.
He's not a prisoner. He's adult court for running away, escaping. It doesn't make him a prisoner-wise there. It makes him a menial to outside the juvenile process.
Fair enough. Good point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the analogy, if you look at the case and the purpose of juvenile law, they mesh, kind of like a synoptic Bible. If you look at the different Gospels all together, they mesh, and I think that's important in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Thank you, Mr. Mills. This matter will stand submitted. The court is in recess.